I started in the ethanol industry in 1982. That was a long time ago. And in New Mexico, of all places, you know, you don't consider New Mexico the home of biofuels, but they were pretty forward-thinking. There were a lot of small ethanol plants that cropped up. At the time, I was a carpenter and heard about some construction going on near the old feed mill at the top of the hill, and went out and applied for work, and they said, sure, you know, you can be a carpenter, come in tomorrow. I came in the next day with my tools, and the guy said, sit them down. There was one plant that was operating. This was a million gallon per year plant. He walked me through. I heard all this noise. I had no idea what he was saying. I thought, this is great. He's showing me all the stuff that's going to go on top of the concrete that I'm going to build, because, you know, carpenters in that sort of construction are form carpentry. And he says, you're a cooker. I said, no, I'm a carpenter. No, you're a cooker. That was my start. Scared the crud out of me, I can tell you, because I had no idea what I was doing or why. And that didn't work very well for me, Tim. I wanted to know why. I kept asking the one person who was there, the distiller, right? There are two jobs in those plants, cooker and distiller. I asked the distiller, why do I do this? He said, well, it just works this way. What happens if I don't? Well, it doesn't work. Okay, can you tell me why? No. And so I went to the university in town in Portales and checked out every book I could find on winemaking, alcohol, moonshine. It didn't matter, anything that would tell me what we were doing, and tried to learn. And so I learned on the job have had the benefit over the years of being able to participate in trying out lots of new technologies. And I can tell you a lot of ways that don't make alcohol, but some that work really well, and that's been kind of fun. But also over the years, as you mentioned, Brian, I learned that it's not enough to just do something because it's fun. I mean, that trips my trigger, I will admit. I'm a little bit of a geek, and I kind of like that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, I have people that I have to report to that want to know what I did with their money. And did I do something that was going to make them money or not? So that's kind of a little tougher criteria. I did a lot of experimentation in my parents' house. I know at one time I was trying to figure out how you could, and this will sound counterintuitive, but how you could increase glycerol production in fermentation, because we were looking at a process to maybe recover glycerol. And it would be a different stream. It would be really primo glycerin for tobaccos, particularly going to the Middle East. You know, great stuff, wonderful stuff, great ideas. Hard to do, but I'm doing these weird fermentations in my parents' house. They were gone, using their kitchen to dry the feed so I could see what the feed looked like. And it didn't smell very good, and so I was wearing a mask, and I would walk out of the house wearing this mask. And now I think back, it was almost like Breaking Bad kind of stuff. That's not very good, you know. Thankfully, that wasn't going on at the time, so nobody came over and asked what I was cooking in the house. But I mean, we've tried a lot of different things, and we continue to look at new technologies all the time. I'm really pleased to say that we're going to be piloting an enzymatic biodiesel process at our facility. At least I think we are. We're still working on the details, but I think that's going to happen. We continue to look at lots of things, and we've been very innovative over the years. Again, trying to find those things that really work, that have good payback, and that make your business sustainable in the long term. That's what all of us have to look for, I believe.
Fantastic. And Randy, maybe we'll stay with you as I segue into this next question, the RFA Smart Brief, that at least certainly I learned of your appointment to the chair position at the RFA. Two priorities for you, RFS certainty, and Mike touched on the other, and that is infrastructure and relief from a rail standpoint. Yeah. And I wanted to ask all of you, we just heard 90 minutes of discussion about policy, and I know how policy affects Joe and Mike and Matt's daily life, right? I know how that affects them. They get calls from their constituents asking them what's going on, how close are we to some sort of favorable resolution. I'm interested in hearing from each of you, how does the RFS impact your organizations on a day-to-day basis? how far down in the ranks at the plants are people talking about the RFS? Is it a talker in break rooms, lunch rooms, or is it, are people just sort of overwhelmed by it and just kind of keep going about doing what they're doing? So, Randy, we start with you.
You know, Tim, I'm not sure about conversation in the lunchroom or break room, because mostly folks are more concerned with, you know, how's the plan operating and how we're going to do, and particularly since they have a great deal of impact from our financial results, how are we doing financially, right?
Right.
Because we have profit sharing in our facility, and our employees kind of keep track of that. They kind of like that thought, especially like this last year. It's been much the buzz. RFS, for the most part, they don't talk about it unless I get them involved in letter writing, which happens from time to time. But the impact for, you know, folks that are in the existing industries, you're asking yourself, what happens to expansion? You know, every business needs to grow to be able to continue to be viable. But you're questioning whether or not the country is going to be supportive of continuing petroleum displacement. And that's really, you know, at the core. I understand that we found lots of new resource, but it's still a finite resource. And are we going to commit to doing something that's renewable or not? That really is concerning. You know, when Congress wrote the law, you know, the first version in what, 2005, second in 2007, that was pretty forward looking. You know, when the first RFS was dreamed up and passed, Congress had these stepwise you know, numbers in there where they thought we could get to with just corn-based ethanol, and by the time the law was inked, we were already at the max. You know, the industry was growing so rapidly, no one considered how quickly the industry could grow when there were really no barriers to entry other than, you know, having a little bit of money in hand, and banks were really behind it. With that kind of climate, you know, where you're actually passing an RFS, you know, and it was bilateral, you know, both Republicans and Democrats were behind it. That's huge. Passing it a second time, you know, with even greater petroleum displacement targets and the targets that it built in for advanced biofuels, for cellulosic biofuels, that was, you know, a totally new world. And everyone said, wow, look at this. We're finally waking up. We're going to do something that's renewable, that's lasting. We're going to displace petroleum. Great. And now you're wondering, you know, and that doubt makes you hesitant to commit capital dollars to something new. I don't know. You know, I'm not involved in advanced biofuels directly. But I wonder if you were going to talk to a bank, how interested are bankers in talking to you? You know, this climate, having gone through building when ethanol wasn't cool, when bankers demanded a lot of equity, you know, those are tough hurdles to meet. And for new industries with what looks like wavering government support, you know, the access to capital is going to be really tough. That is a part of what the RFS signals. Letting EPA decide arbitrarily, illegally, to say, no, we're gonna cap you at 10% blend, when the whole legislation was looking for much more than that, is unbelievable. I can't believe it's happened. And that's really our concern. It's not about the number. I'm not sweating the number. What concerns me is the philosophy.
Right.
You know, what is EPA going to say was their basis for making any change when more than adequate supply is available? And in the language of the law, it's only about supply. So I wonder what that does to us.